McGovern, surveys taken since the president's latest speech on Watergate indicate that that speech left many Americans unsatisfied and unconvinced. Are you among them?
Yes, I am. I would like to believe that the president is innocent either of any knowledge of the Watergate incident or of the cover-up, but he's making it increasingly hard for any of us to hold to that view.
From CBS News, Washington, Face the Nation on the CBS Radio Network, a spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with the 1972 Democratic presidential nominee, Senator George McGovern, Democrat of South Dakota. Senator McGovern will be questioned by CBS News reporter Connie Chung, Martin Nolan, Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe, and CBS News correspondent Barry Serafin.
Dear volunteers, my friend and I are interested in volunteering. He's 11 and I'm 12. The reason I'm writing you, because when I was in fifth grade, I had an ecology chapter in social studies, and I loved it, and I wish you could tell us what to do about it. For 1 month, my girlfriend and I got up early in the morning and picked up papers and other things from the ground. Now we wish we could do more.
Gentlemen, I'm a lawyer. Possibly I could be of some help to veterans. In any event, if you can suggest areas where I could help, I will do my best. A P.S., my wife will help too.
If you don't know what to volunteer for, call a volunteer service in your town or write to Volunteer, Washington, D.C., 20013. We can tell you who needs your help. And what we need, money can't buy. We need you. This public service message brought to you on behalf of the National Center for Voluntary Action and the Advertising Council.
Now, once again, here is CBS News correspondent Barry Serafin.
Senator McGovern, what did you want the president to say that he didn't say the other night in his Watergate speech?
Well, I thought there were at least two things that the president might have done to improve confidence in him. Number one, a point-by-point rebuttal of the charges that have been made. He declined to do that. The other alternative that he had to clear up some of the unanswered questions was to offer to release the tapes. I can't buy the notion that there's some kind of peculiar right that the president has to place himself above the rights of inquiry of the Congress of the United States. And I think by declining either to rebut the charges that have been made by his own top aides, or in the absence of that, to release the tape recordings, which both Mr. Cox, the special prosecutor, and the Irvin Committee have requested, the president has made it very hard for us to accept the argument that he advances that he had nothing to do either with the cover-up of the Watergate incident or its original planning.
Well, Senator, the president's lawyers have gone before Judge Sirica in district court here with two basic arguments. One is that the president is not subject to federal court jurisdiction because of the inherent powers of the presidency, and the other is based on the confidentiality and the need for privileged conversation in the Oval Office. Don't you think if you were president, your lawyers would be arguing the same way?
Well, in the first place, Mr. Nolan, if I had been president, I don't think I would be involved in this kind of enterprise. I think that I would have tried to run the kind of an open government that would not have permitted a tragedy of this kind to take place. I don't think the separation of powers doctrine confers any power on any branch of the government. What it does is to say that there are certain powers that each branch of the government has, but it doesn't increase that power. And there is nowhere that I can find in the Constitution that the president is given a grant of secrecy, or that where he's given a grant to place himself above the claims of the judiciary or the Congress. That's an invention that the president has advanced that I find no basis in constitutional law. I had a long talk over the last couple of days with Professor Berger of Harvard University, who's one of our leading authorities in this field, and has spent a lifetime searching the Constitution. He says nowhere can he find the doctrine of executive privilege spelled out in any fashion that would justify the president saying that he has an absolute right to decide what information should be released either to the Congress or to the courts with reference to his conduct. Certainly he has no right to cover up wrongdoing in the name of secrecy.
Senator, though, to consider the question of confidentiality, wouldn't you want to protect your private conversations with your top advisors?
Well, of course, we all want to be able to carry on confidential conversations, but I think where the president made a mistake in the first instance was not advising those who talked with him that their messages were being recorded. That's a great invasion of the privacy of the individual. The president talks about his rights. What about the rights of those who talk with him, the heads of other governments, the heads of government departments? Most, if not all of them, apparently knew nothing about the taping of their conversations. But the point is that when the president and his aides get into serious difficulty, as they have over the Watergate incident, and we have evidence on tape that would either clarify the innocence of those people or else convict them, I find no basis in the Constitution or anywhere else for that information being withheld. Now, let me go on to make this point. I think Watergate happened in the first place in part because of an excessive secrecy around the White House. The tendency on the part of the president to surround himself with a small palace guard, not to talk to members of the Congress, not to subject himself to interrogation by the press except at rare intervals. Even top leaders of his own party in the Congress could not gain access to him. Under those circumstances of a closed operation, of airtight secrecy, the temptation to wrongdoing is greatly enhanced.
Now, Senator, to take that wrongdoing up, you said in an article last week in the Washington Post, the president claims a presumption of innocence while his actions invite an assumption of guilt. Now, do you have some suspicions that the president is guilty in some way of criminal acts?
Well, I'm not going to make any statement to try to convict the president at this point. The investigation is still proceeding. The special prosecutor is moving ahead with his investigation. Senator Ervin and his group are asking questions, and that will continue for some time to come. I think we have to wait until more evidence is in before we reach a final judgment. But the point is that the president, by his actions, is making it very hard for those of us who would like to believe in the integrity of his conduct to hold to that view. Why doesn't the president release the tapes? Why don't we have a point-by-point rebuttal of the charges that have been made? Now, some very serious questions have been raised about Watergate. The president said he repeatedly inquired all last summer how the investigation was coming into the Watergate break-in. But when Mr. Mitchell testified, when Mr. Kleindienst testified, when Mr. Gray, the acting head of the FBI, testified, they said they'd had no inquiry at all from the president as to how the investigation was proceeding. Well, who did the president think was in charge of the investigation if it were not the attorney general or the head of the criminal division at the Department of Justice or the acting head of the FBI? Who was running this investigation that the president said he repeatedly inquired about all during the summer and fall of 1972? Those are the kind of questions that I think the American people want answered.
Senator Patrick Buchanan, a presidential aide and speechwriter, argues that criticism like yours of the tapes, specifically in the question of executive privilege, and in fact the actions of some of the people in Watergate, represent a double standard that liberals are doing an about-face, that, for instance, during the McCarthy hearings, they supported executive privilege and the maintaining of confidential conversations by President Eisenhower. Is it a double standard that's being applied?
I don't think it is a double standard, but in any event, I don't hold to the doctrine of executive privilege at any time. But the circumstances are vastly different. No one was accusing President Eisenhower of wrongdoing. No one was accusing him of criminal behavior. The integrity of his administration had not been thrown into question, was it when it was, in one instance, over the case involving Sherman Adams accepting gifts under difficult circumstances. The president fired him. But it's vastly different to deny an irresponsible politician such as the late Joe McCarthy from engaging in a fishing expedition into the State Department on the viewpoints, the ideology of various members of the State Department as over against an effort on the part of a special prosecutor and a duly constituted committee of the Senate to try to get at the evidence of what is believed to be criminal behavior. I think the two circumstances are vastly different.
Senator, you said you were talking with Professor Berger of the Harvard Law School. Well, he's also noted as an expert on impeachment, has written a book about that subject. Did you talk with him about that?
I talked to him in general terms about it. I think it's premature for any of us in the Congress to be advocating impeachment at this point. But I would say this, Mr. Nolan. If the president remains steadfast in his refusal to turn over the tapes, even if the courts hold that he has an obligation to do so, then the Congress will have no other recourse except to give serious consideration to impeachment.
You're using the word premature when you may mean inevitable. I mean, it's a semantic difficulty there.
Well, I want to wait until we find out what the president does in the event we get a court order asking him to turn over the tapes. He has already replied in a preliminary way that he's not going to respond to the subpoena asking for the tapes. We're now waiting for the final ruling of the federal court. It may go all the way to the Supreme Court. When that process is completed, if the Supreme Court holds that the President of the United States must turn over the tapes and other evidence in his possession bearing on this case, and he refuses, then there's no recourse except for the Congress to give serious consideration to impeachment.
Now, the President says, however, he would push for dismissing the cases, that the prosecution would drop the cases if the courts forced him to turn over the tapes because he has absolute power.
I don't agree with that. I don't think the president does have absolute power to make that judgment, and I find no constitutional authority for that. I think this question ultimately will be decided in the courts. The courts, after all, have the right to determine what is constitutional and what is not. And they will, in due course, pass judgment on whether the president has the right to withhold those tapes or not. I do want to say this. The president is more than a lawyer. He's also the leader of the American people. He has a serious credibility problem with the American people. Without reference to the legal aspects of this point, I would strongly recommend to President Nixon that he not only release the tapes, but that he make a full accounting of everything that he knows about this Watergate tragedy. The Watergate incident is more than the break-in of the Democratic headquarters. It involves a set of attitudes that jeopardize our whole constitutional system, attitudes that place ends above means, that place deception above open democracy, that place political expediency, including the winning of an election, above even considerations of criminal behavior on the part of one's subordinates. Now, those are the kind of attitudes that have disturbed the American people about this administration and perhaps some previous administrations. And the only way we're going to clear up these terrible doubts about our leadership is for the leadership to come clean with the American people, to go beyond even the mere legal requirements, and to open up, to give us the facts, to rebut the points that can be made, if indeed rebuttals are there. And in fact, I think it would be a good idea for the president either to appear before the Ervin Committee or at least invite Senator Ervin and Senator Baker, the chairman and ranking member of the White House, to discuss this matter.
Now, the dirty tricks is one problem, or the so-called dirty tricks is one thing that perhaps the American people are worried about. There's a newspaper report today that Lucianne Goldberg, a reporter who was covering your campaign, and someone I remember well, was receiving $1,000 a week to spy on your campaign. And the article says that she was supposed to dig up sort of dirty stuff, and she has now told CBS News that she was merely giving scheduling information. Now, I remember Lucianne Goldberg, and we had always wondered what she, who she worked for. She had been writing, apparently, as we understood it, one of those instant books that would be out a day after the election or so. Do you remember her, or do you have any suspicions about her? Did you at all check out her
I don't remember her. I have no reason to doubt the story, but I can't place her. Apparently, she was one of the press corps in the employ of Mr. Chotiner, or in the employ of the committee to reelect the president, but I have no recollection of her.
Were you at all surprised to receive this, to read about this report, though?
No. We've had previous reports about various spies that were planted in our headquarters, Ruby 1, Ruby 2, various other people who went under code names. So we've known for some time that our campaign was spied upon from the inside, that it was sabotaged, and that some of the difficulties we had were brought about because of that practice. But I can't recall this particular instance.
Well, in light of that, and the fact that a Secret Service agent supposedly passed some information to his father, then to the White House, and there were reports that that the Nixon campaign committee was trying to get some information on some of your top advisors. In light of this, do you think that the so-called dirty tricks had any effect on your campaign? That did it at all steal the presidential election away from
you? Well, certainly the cover-up of those activities denied us a possible victory. Every mistake we made in the McGovern campaign was made before the election in full public view. I don't think there was a secret in our campaign. And the American people made an assessment of the McGovern campaign based on all of the things that had happened before the election. They knew about those things. And we made some mistakes. We didn't do anything dishonest. We didn't steal any money. We ran the most honest and forthright campaign in the way we handled our campaign contributions, I think, in American history. We raised $30 million in small contributions, frankly, all of it in small contributions, no corporate checks. But we did make a few mistakes that were brought out in open. I think if the things that were done on the other side, the cover-up, the massive cover-up of the Watergate incidents, the mishandling of campaign funds, if those things had been fully known before the election, the results would have been quite different. In fact, a recent poll shows that we would have won the election if people were voting today.
Senator, the Irvin Committee voted unanimously to obtain the records from your campaign in terms of campaign financing. Have those records been subpoenaed?
Yes, I think they have. And in any event, I or any member of the campaign organization would be more than happy to appear before the Irvin Committee. We have absolutely nothing to hide. I remember on several occasions we got corporate contributions from people who didn't know it was a violation of the law. We immediately returned them. Now, there's a double standard that's been set up in the way this kind of breaking of the law has been treated by the administration. They apparently went out and deliberately shook down corporations, received large contributions from many corporations, four of whom have come forward and confessed it. But apparently there's no punishment. They're given a light tap on the wrist, and the money's returned, and that's it. I think we've got a double standard functioning here in which we treat a kind of a white-collar violation of the law vastly different from what we would treat, say, a break-in of a grocery store where $100 is stolen. The man, if he were caught, would go to the penitentiary. Here we have millions of dollars misused and mishandled. And thus far, nothing but a minor reprimand.
There was a General Accounting Office report indicating that records were not properly kept. One of your committees, the Wisconsin Committee, have you checked into that?
Yes, I have. Both in Wisconsin and Connecticut, they said that our state committees had not filled out some of the forms properly. They checked the Connecticut record and found out it was in perfect order. They're now in the process of doing that in Wisconsin. And I don't have any doubt at all that that record will be found proper, too. But I can tell you this, Mr. Serafin, if there were any mistakes made by our state committees, they were done inadvertently. There was no effort to cover up anything. We tried to publish every single dollar we got. We didn't take anything in the way of a cash contribution other than maybe $1 or $5 dropped in the plate at a rally, but no big cash contributions. Everything was received and accounted for and published at the time.
Senator, the Sunday before the election last November, you were scheduled to be on Face the Nation, but I think an electrical workers' strike wiped it out. If we knew then what we know now about Watergate, would your answer about the inevitability of victory have been different. The reason I ask that is because it's traditional for anyone, and even in the face of defeat, to boast about a victory. Do you think it really would have been that different if all of the facts had come out?
Well, Mr. Nolan, I don't think it would have on the basis of Watergate alone, but I think that other factors would have loomed even more important in people's minds. For example, the complete inability of this administration to handle inflation. They don't seem to know what to do with the cost of living. They don't seem to know what to do with the food crisis. They don't seem to know what to do with the energy crisis. And they're continuing what I regard as the most serious single problem in American life today, and that's this military globalism that is wasting billions of our dollars overseas on needless military ventures, needless military installations. We ought to curtail those operations, bring a substantial portion of our troops home, and begin dealing with our problems here at home. Our problems are right here in America. And I think the American people are perhaps even more disturbed about the inability of this administration to manage the central problems of this country here at home. Here we had a situation where last year they sold one-fourth of our wheat crop to the biggest communist country in the world at bargain prices, sold it about $1.60 a bushel. Now we're paying $5 a bushel because of the inability to look ahead and see what the needs would be for grain. And that same administration that sold a fourth of our wheat crop to the biggest communist country in the world has been spending billions of dollars bombing some of the tiniest and weakest communist countries in the world on the theory that we can't afford to let communism succeed anywhere in the world. I think that's a preposterous situation for us to be in.
Senator, you sound as though you have not exactly forsworn presidential politics. I think after the election, you indicated you would not be a presidential candidate again. Have all the facts that have come out since that time changed your mind?
No,
wavered you a bit?
Mr. Nolan, I never forswore the right to speak out on national issues. I am a United States Senator. I'm running for election next year, and I think the great issues that we raised in 1972 are now coming to be better understood and appreciated by the American people. They appreciate the need to have less international military intervention and more attention to our problems here at home. Problems of crime, the problems of health. The president said in his speech the other night that Watergate is such an obsession by the Congress that we're neglecting the health of the American people. Well, we've passed three major health bills which the president has vetoed. We've passed other health legislation where he has impounded the funds. We've passed legislation to strengthen our schools and take some of the pressure off local property taxpayers. He's either vetoed or impounded the money for those programs. There's no real planning going on in dealing with any of the central problems before this country here at home. And I think any of us in the United States Senate who are concerned about America have an obligation to speak out on those issues.
Now, Senator, to follow up on Marty's question, though, in light of the Quayle poll, which said today, if the election were to be held, that you would receive 51% of the vote, and President Nixon would receive 49% of the vote. Also, you wrote in your article that you thought your overwhelming defeat and the Watergate revelations were better for the country, and that these things have awakened the country.
Yes.
Now, in light of that, it has been said that perhaps the country wasn't ready for you in 72. Do you think, in light of the awakening, the country might be ready for you in 76?
Well, I think the country is more ready right now for the ideas that we raised in 1972. I'm not going to speculate on 76 three and a half years ahead of time. I do think there are certain changes that we ought to press for in this country and in the presidency. I've been thinking as this line of questions has developed about Watergate that we need to be asking ourselves how to prevent future developments of that kind. And one way, in addition to putting an end to the excessive secrecy at the White House, is to cut down on the size of the president's executive staff. I don't know how many Americans are aware that we have almost 2,000 people working on the White House staff. Those people have become more powerful than the cabinets in our country. I would like to see a restoration of the dignity and the integrity and the importance of the cabinet. When I was a boy growing up, every schoolboy could name President Roosevelt's cabinet. He was a very colorful and effective president, but we all knew who his cabinet was. Today, there isn't one American in 1,000 who could name the cabinet. So the cabinet's been reduced to a powerless branch of our government, and the power has shifted over to these nameless people in the White House who weren't elected to anything and who were never confirmed by the Senate, incidentally. And that's the second suggestion I would make, that the president's top-level appointees on his White House staff, men like Ehrlichman and Haldeman and Kissinger, those people ought to be subject to confirmation by the Senate.
Senator, we have less than a minute left, and I don't want to be accused of wallowing in Watergate, but are there any other dirty tricks that came up in your campaign that we don't know about that you do?
I think the dirty tricks have been pretty well exposed. What I'm most anxious to see is the next phase of the Watergate investigation by the Urban Committee, which is going to look into the whole matter of campaign financing. I think one of the reasons why we don't have a workable antitrust policy in this administration, why we don't have an adequate inflation control program in this administration, why we've done nothing on tax reform to close some of the loopholes that benefit the rich and the powerful, is because they bought their way with campaign contributions a certain freedom from those things.
Thank you, Senator. We're out of time. Thank you for being here to Face the Nation.
A professor of psychology revealing the complexities of man's behavior. A student drinking in this knowledge and expanding her world. An attorney guiding a client through legal tangles. What do these people have in common? They were all born with cerebral palsy. And the professor, the student, the attorney, and the messenger, and the clerk as well, have all proven one important thing. They are functioning in spite of their handicaps. When you're born with the brain damage that results in the condition we call cerebral palsy, it takes a lot of determination and courage to surmount that handicap. But that's not all it takes. United Cerebral Palsy is an agency that helps, but not without you. This is Richard Kiley. A lot of people with cerebral palsy will make a better life for themselves because when United Cerebral Palsy asked, you were there.
Today on Face the Nation, Senator George McGovern, Democrat of South Dakota, was interviewed by CBS News reporter Connie Chung, Martin Nolan, Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe, and CBS News correspondent Barry Serafin. Next week, another prominent figure in the news will face the nation. Today's broadcast was recorded earlier in Washington and is a production of CBS News. This is the CBS Radio Network.
This is FM 102. WBEN FM, Buffalo.